Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. Talking Records Podcast. We talk about our favorite records. Talking Records Podcast. We're so glad you tuned in. Thank you all for listening. You showed up to the right place. Jed and his friends dive deep and analyze the records we have grown to love. We'll tell you how we found the band, then give you a track by track breakdown of all songs. So grab your favorite beverage and pull up a seat. Today we'll look at another record in its entirety.
Hello, what's up everyone? My name is Jed and you're listening to the Talking Records Podcast, an album deep dive show where we focus on one album and round up everything we can about it. In a moment, we'll be joined by Goldfinger guitarist Charlie and bassist Kelly to discuss Goldfinger's 2000 album, Stomping Ground. To help with that, I'm joined today by my friend and fellow podcaster, Kyle. What's up, Kyle?
What up? How you doing, Jed?
Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, man. I really appreciate it. I had so much fun on the last one.
I always enjoy chatting with you, man, whether it's on this podcast or on your podcast or just through Instagram messaging or, you know, posts. It's so good to know that there are people around the world, around the country that I can just chat music with, you know?
Yeah, dude. Yeah. No, it was probably 3 or 4 years ago, a good friend of mine and a personal training client, actually, that's what my day job, he told me about the Talking Records podcast. And awesome. He's a huge Strung Out fan, and he was like, you got to check out this podcast. And so I started listening to your podcast, and it's so cool because we've become friends, and I've been on your show now a couple times, and you've been on my show as well. It's just cool how that works out.
I know. I feel like I've grown up with you. It's pretty wild. But yeah, thanks, man. So we are here. We're going to talk about Goldfinger today. I'm so excited to have the guys on to chat about this record. So Kyle, we were talking back and forth about, you know, possible albums to do, and we both kind of landed on this one, and we're like, yes, let's do Stomping Ground. So tell me, how did you discover Goldfinger, and what does Stomping Ground as an album mean to you?
Yeah, you know, I remember distinctly hearing your bedroom on the radio. We were one of those alternative stations in Kansas City. We had one, thankfully, that played that song, and I absolutely loved it because it melded the Mighty Mighty Boston's and Green Day to me, and I just absolutely loved it. And discovered Less Than Jake around the same time, but I really loved that self-titled record and Hang Ups. And I remember the first time I heard Stomping Ground, if I can tell a really quick story, I would go to, once I could drive, I would go to CD Warehouse and I would hang out there after school. And this particular CD Warehouse would sell used CDs, of course, but they would sell new CDs too. And all of their new CDs would be displayed on the wall, and they had a little listening station. Nice. And I remember thinking, oh, I didn't realize Goldfinger had a new record out, because they had it prominently displayed on the wall, Stomping Ground. And I think it had come out March early that year. And I immediately listened to it, and I heard I'm Down. And I really loved Hang Ups. I loved the ska-centric nature of it, but I loved their aggressive punk rock too, especially from the first album. And I'm Down just kicks in full gear. It's got that double time beat, those aggressive guitars, but it also just sounded better than anything I'd ever heard at that point. It sounded like a major label release, but it had that punk rock attitude, and I just fell in love immediately, and I had to buy it.
I love that opener because it's like, take the catchiest part of your song, put it first with a little guitar, and I'm like, yeah. I mean, the first time I heard that, I was hooked, so.
Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah, it's an earworm for sure.
Yeah, when I had Charlie on episode 50, we talked about the self-titled album. I kind of went into how I got into Goldfinger there, but, you know, the short of it is, heard him on the radio, loved the sound, didn't even know what ska or punk was way back when I first heard Goldfinger, just loved the music. You know, it was bright, it was exciting, it was high energy. I always loved it when they did the heavier, more aggressive stuff. Loved Hang Ups, you know, for a time. That record came out in the sweet spot of just like when ska was huge. I loved Hang Ups. But when this record came out, there was just something about it, and I think you hit it. It was just, it sounded great. The songs were amazing. I felt like the band had really hit their stride. You know, you can tell when a band does a lot of touring, and then they make an album like this, you're just like, wow, they're on the top of their game.
Absolutely.
And I just loved all the songs on this one. You know, there aren't too many places on this record where my mind starts to wander. You know, it's just one great song after another. Love Carry On, love Counting the Days, San Simeon, you know, even songs that are a little bit more rocky, a little more like, it's like really like musical, like really poppy, really like interesting to listen to.
Yeah. And it's really eclectic record. And I'd be curious to know your thoughts. When you were listening to it, there are some moments where it goes into a different territory for them.
Sure.
And did you notice that right away when listening?
Yeah, you know, they'd always been to me pretty eclectic. You know, if you listen to self-titled, you've got King for a Day, which is like straight up, you know, reggae. But then you've got like Mind's Eye, which is straightforward punk rock. And then you've got City of Two Faces, where John's screaming. And then you've got, you know, Stay, which is really bouncy. So I was kind of like expecting more of that from them. But then like to bring it to the next level on this record, to me, was just like, wow, you know, it's, they're not a fluke. You know, this band can do it.
Absolutely, for sure. Yeah, and you know, I'm a huge John Feldmann fan. I like his production and all of the bands he's worked with over the years. I still hear echoes of some of the production elements from this record, even records I hear today, because I know he had a hand in that. And I'm sure we're going to talk about Tim Palmer, the producer, but I would imagine that maybe John had that production hat on for some of the songs, and he was giving ideas, and maybe they were playing off of ideas, and maybe Tim gave John some ideas that he still used. Mm-hmm. Just certain effects on the guitars, the bass, and even vocal filters on a lot of the songs just make the chorus pop. I love all that stuff.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I don't doubt it, man.
Make sure you check out Talking Records on the net. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Talking Records Podcast. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, or X. You can also drop us an email at talkingrecords@outlook.com. These are all great ways for us to connect with you over all this great music.
All right, well, let's get into it. Goldfinger released Stomping Ground on March 28th, 2000 on Mojo Jive, Jive Records. Here to tell us more about the album are Charlie and Kelly. Welcome to the podcast, Charlie, Kelly. Welcome to Talking Records, guys.
Hey, how you doing? This is Charlie Paulson. This is the sound of my voice.
This is Kelly Lemieux, and that's the sound of Charlie's voice.
Welcome, guys. We are thrilled that you're here. We have a bunch of questions about Stomping Ground and trying to get a sense of where, you know, the writing process or the genesis of this album is. I guess, Kelly, maybe it starts with you coming over from 22 Jacks. Tell us about your path to the band.
Oh my goodness. I'll give you the Reader's Digest version. Electric Love Hogs with John. One record on London Polygram. John split. I think they carried on under a couple of different names. You know, other guys in the band, we can name drop all day. Google it. It's on Wikipedia. But everybody went and did other stuff. And then I went and did a bunch of other stuff. And then I believe the 22 Jacks supported Goldfinger in 97. And then cut to Simon wanted to go home for Christmas and, or no, for his sister's wedding, but Christmas was 2 weeks later. And so they asked me to fill in and do those shows. And then, I don't know, about 8 months later, I was kind of touring with them and doing band stuff or something like that. Right?
Nice.
Does that sound right, Paul, Charlie?
Yeah. Simon had to take some time off. We all knew Kelly. We all knew he could do the job. We all liked Kelly. So, he filled in, and when it became obvious that Simon was not going to keep going with the band, Kelly was the obvious and only choice. We didn't even audition. We didn't audition anybody else, and we didn't even have to audition Kelly because we already knew.
Yeah, because he had filled in. Nice. And I guess your playing had been described at the time, Kelly, as maybe being a little bit more aggressive than Simon.
Well, yeah. I mean, I played a lot of different styles stylistically too, and I guess Simon did. I don't really know a lot. I mean, he just seemed, I flew out before I did that last, so I did a little like winter run, so Simon was actually out there, and I watched them because I didn't really have any rehearsals, I like did like one or two sound checks and then we fucking were off and running. So I just noticed that Simon was more of a, he was like really into like the Blur, Blur, the radio, why I keep saying the Radiohead, all those kind of Anglophile sort of bands that were kind of hot at that moment. So I think that was more of, and he's a Kiwi, he's from New Zealand, so I think he just has more British leanings anyways. But yeah,
Simon is a great pick player. He has a great melodic sense.
yes.
But Kelly can do that and everything else.
But I can play with my
Kelly,
fingers too, if I have to.
yeah, exactly. Simon's a great bass player. Kelly's a fucking virtuoso.
Oh, easy now. I'm gonna have to fucking Venmo you some
Look
money.
at his head. His head is exploding.
What's your Venmo again, Charlie?
Yeah, we'll talk afterwards. But no, I
Like,
mean,
don't go too hard, bro. I'm not rich. No, I'm just kidding.
Kelly Lemieux is fucking, he's hands down top five bass players in rock, period. End of
Oh, my
discussion.
man.
Like, there's no question.
Thank you,
There's,
buddy. I love you.
Kelly is absolutely a fucking beast. I would put him up against anybody.
Oh
Nice.
shit, that's some fucking
So,
fighting words.
I love it,
wow.
man. You guys knew
God
each other though,
damn.
too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, when Kelly was in the Love Hogs with John, I used to guitar tech for them. So I had known Kelly for
Oh, nice.
probably 10 years before
How old
he
were you?
started playing with
19 when
us.
I met you?
19, yeah.
Wow.
So fuck, maybe. Yeah, so
So like what?
eight or
20,
10 years.
25 years now?
Yeah, sure.
I love it.
No one's doing math. It's okay.
I said 19, not zero.
So, Kelly, when you joined the Goldfinger, did you have a lot of experience playing ska and reggae and punk rock? I mean, you did Fear, the Fear tour too, right?
I was playing with Fear. I played
Not that they
well,
played ska, but
the 22 Jacks was very
right.
Elvis Costello-y, clashy sort of bass driven. And I try to be well rounded. I mean, I like shit, I played upright in country bands, you know what I mean? I'm like, I just like to play bass.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So I studied a lot of Bruce Thomas from Elvis Costello. I'm like, all right, I'm gonna find the guy that overplays and then take it back a notch.
I love that.
So,
Did
yeah.
so how quickly did you guys start writing together? Had you guys toured a little bit and then it was time to make a new record? How involved were you in the writing process for Stomping Ground?
I think they had a lot of it written already on that one. And or we did. Charlie, do you remember like rehearsing in John's old house over in Santa Monica or wherever he was, Marina Del Rey?
We're stomping around.
Yeah, he had that. Remember, he had electronic kid in there.
I remember that more for Open Your Eyes. I don't. Oh yeah. I remember
No,
that.
we
We
rehearsed there. Yeah, we did rehearse there. You know why I
yeah.
remember?
We also rehearsed at Cole Rehearsal in Hollywood with the now defunct Cole Rehearsal, which is where Rage Against the Machine made their second record.
This is true.
Oh yeah.
The what back
Nice. A
when
lot of those songs also. A lot of those songs also. Started forming on the Hang Ups tour when Kelly was playing with us. I remember jamming a lot of those songs, or at least parts of those songs,
for
at
sure.
Soundcheck. I remember You Think It's a Joke,
Bro, maybe?
Bro, maybe Pick a Fight. A lot of those songs started as Soundcheck jams. San Simeon for sure. Feldy back then was always writing. Always, like in the back of the bus on a little four track. I remember one time we took a ferry from probably from France to England. And Feldy just as an experiment wanted to see if he could write and record a whole song in transit.
Wow.
So he got the germ of this idea. I don't know if anything ever happened with the song, but he got the germ of this idea in his hotel room. On the plane, he was programming drums, and then we got to the fair. Yeah, we were coming from Germany to England and to France, and then so he programmed the drums on the plane. He was writing lyrics the whole time, and then on the ferry, he recorded some guitars. I don't know how. This was before amp modelers, and then I think he sang the vocals into his laptop on an airplane bathroom.
Oh,
Like the dude
that's
was
amazing.
just obsessed. He was constantly writing and recording. And if not that, then he was, you know, working on other people's demos and shit like that. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. So the idea that a lot of those songs came to fruition on tour is not uncommon for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I remember you guys were touring so much.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. For sure. At the time, yeah.
I remember the thing that I remember the most out of those sessions is driving out to John's place in Marina Del Rey, completely like, those were probably, I don't drink anymore. Actually, it'd be 19 years next month. But it was some of the most functioning hungover I've ever done in my life. I remember being fucking green going into one of those, just going, please God, it's like 4 hours. I can get through this. We're like trying just not to puke while we were doing it. There was one of them really that still sticks in my mind to this day. That's how I was just like, oh, all right. But yes, that's what I really remember from that. Sad.
Holding it together.
Sad. Brutal hangovers.
Dude, I was still young. So, I mean, they must have been bad.
I remember being in the studio with Kelly. Well, Kelly and I did, when Kelly first joined the band, we did everything together. When he first joined the band, he was just, had just broken up with his girlfriend who he was living with. So he stayed at my house for a while.
Oh, that's right.
We started running together, right. Working out.
Yeah.
When we tracked Stomping Grounds, he and I were in the studio together every day.
Yeah, we were.
Like, even if I wasn't tracking, I'd be there for his bass parts and vice versa. I was so stoked to be playing with him and to like, I had like this new buddy in the band. So like, and I just remember being fucking blown away because almost every song that we did, he would just nail in the first pass. And if he had to do another take at something, it was because he wanted to try a different idea.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I remember Tim Palmer,
yeah, him Tim. Later,
the producer,
yeah,
just being fucking stoked on us. Do you know what I mean? On how quick and efficient we were. Yeah, it was cool. Something really fucking noteworthy about that record to me is the guy that engineered it. Yes. I think his name is Mark Thompson.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He engineered Highway to Hell and For Those About to Rock.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to.
So, dude, Kelly and I used to pump him for AC/DC stories.
Tell us everything you know.
I know. I can't remember any of them, though.
But the one that stands out to me the most is he said they would track all day, whatever they had to do for the record. And then with Bon and with Brian, at the end of the day, you know, they wouldn't go out to the pub or whatever. They would have some beers brought in or whatever and dinner. And then they would just all go into the live room and just fucking play all night. They would play Chuck Berry covers. They would play Stone songs. They would play whatever. They just loved being a band and playing. And that's why they're so fucking tight.
That's great.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And he was just this wry, funny little Dudley Moore style English dude.
Yeah, you know he's what I mean? Rad.
Yeah, he was fun. And Tim was English, so they brought a really cool element to making of that record. So we had made the first two records, and they were, you know, pretty straight ahead pop punk with some ska.
Yeah.
And on Stomping Ground, we wanted to stretch our fucking wings a little bit because everybody in the band, like, you know, Darren came from New York hardcore,
mm-hmm.
but he also was kind of an Anglophile. He loved the Smiths. He loved them. Yeah. Loved the Smiths. He loved the Cardigans and shit like that.
Oh, I love Cardigans.
You know, I came from AC/DC and Van Halen and, you know, Kelly came from like funk and jazz, and Feldy just being Feldy, just he had so many fucking ideas and shit that he wanted to express. It was the thing about Stomping Grounds was we wanted to break out of the box a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And, you know, Tim and Mark would bring me these cool pedals into the studio, like, hey, you know, they were so stoked. They're like, I thought you might want to try this on this song or whatever. And so it was just a time of experimentation for us. And also It was an age of, like, you had Korn and Rage Against the Machine and the Deftones really sort of expanding the guitar vocabulary at the time. Mm-hmm. And I could do a lot of that shit and had been doing a lot of that shit before Goldfinger. So it was cool for me to get in there and throw a little bit of that shit onto the record. And, yeah. Kelly played five strings. So it was a time of experimentation for us, for all of us.
That's awesome.
And also, it's funny. I listened to the record yesterday to prepare for this. And I realized I haven't listened to that record in at least a decade.
I was just listening to it right before this. I'm like, man, I better freshen
up. How did it hold up?
Weird. There's some, definitely some left turns on that record for us.
For sure.
Yeah.
It's
also some of Darren's best drumming.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like his drumming on that record was masterful,
unbelievable, yeah. And the drums still sound so good. That mix.
Yeah. Well, that was another thing. It was the first time we'd worked with an outside producer and an outside mixer. It was really interesting to hear how somebody from outside of our immediate family interpreted the band.
Yeah,
what I mean?
Yeah.
Like Tim Palmer did not come from anything remotely close to punk rock. The biggest thing he'd done before that was he had mixed Pearl Jam 10.
Yeah.
He'd worked with U2. He'd worked with Tears for Fears. And I remember him and John, it got a little heated because John was like, you have to turn the kick drum up. More kick drum.
Yeah.
There has to be more. Like, we're playing that fast. You can't hear the kick drum.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it was interesting to hear how somebody from outside of our world interpreted our music.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And was Jay there as well? Jay Rifkin?
He didn't have much to do with it.
Nope. No. Never saw him there.
Okay. Can't believe everything you read on the internet.
No, don't. It's funny.
I think he might have been executive producer. Like he wanted to get his name on the record. But I think Jay Moore was he didn't do much.
Okay.
Not on that one.
Nope.
Jay was very, very present on the first two records, though. So he definitely put his time in with us. I think he was just like, I'm not doing that shit again.
Yeah.
I'm out.
He probably thought Darren was gonna beat him up for real this time.
Yeah, that's the other thing. The making of Stomping Ground was the easiest record we had done up to that point. I mean, we are Goldfinger, so we have fucking tension.
Yeah.
We have static, but
should be tension finger.
It was certainly the smoothest record we had made up until that point.
That's
yeah,
good.
I remember it's like I remember like the only weird thing that happened is that I remember. Is John wanted to track some of his guitars at his place. Do you remember that, Charlie?
Oh, yeah. He did most of his guitars and vocals at his house.
Yeah. Which was, like, I'm sure pissed him off a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, he got used to it.
So by this point, had John, he was pretty familiar with the studio. He was pretty familiar with – how did you guys record this? Was this to tape or Pro Tools?
Ooh, Charlie.
It was to
– Charlie, tell him where we recorded it.
Yeah. Fuck, what's the name of that place?
I can't remember, but
it's someplace north Hollywood.
It was
a cool little studio.
It used to be fucking Foxy. it was Super Tramps.
Oh,
you remember?
Oh, really?
It was Super Tramps, and then I think they hang on. No, not the Village. Hang on. Why do I remember Tito Jackson? It was Tito Jackson's. That's what it was. How I got that confused with Super Tramp, I don't know.
Now that you mentioned that, I know part of Breakfast in America was recorded there, and I know part of the Jackson's Victory record was recorded
I think
there.
Tito owned that studio. I think it used to be his.
Yeah, but it was a tiny little unassuming. If you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know it was there.
Put it this way. I've driven by it numerous times, and I don't know where it is. Since then. Seriously.
I've been in the neighborhood.
Every time I drive by, I'm all, fuck, because there's all these doors. It's on Magnolia.
It looks like a little storefront.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like Cherokee Reporters
exactly.
Back in the day. You wouldn't know that. If you didn't know it was there, you wouldn't know it was there.
That, they do that on purpose so they don't get ripped off.
Yeah.
You guys have Media Vortex, Foxy something, and The Village.
The Village.
On here.
Yeah.
The Village Recorders. Is that it?
No, The Village is a big fancy studio in Santa Monica.
What are we doing in Village?
I don't remember. I know that we recorded our Buzzcocks cover there, So You Don't Love Me.
Maybe that's... Yeah. Oh, that wasn't on that, though.
Yeah, but that's not on that record. We might have done something there. It might have been Media Vortex. Mm-hmm. God, I'm sure this is so fascinating to the listeners.
I know. Hey, where did we do I Love You More Today Than Yesterday? Where did we do that at?
Oh, that was at Sunset Sound, where the fucking Van Halen recording studio, The Doors, like, nice. Hendrix, everybody fucking recorded there.
That's incredible. There. You think it's a joke, I find no reason why I should laugh at you. You think it's a joke to take advantage of the life that supports you.
Some of the weirder shit on there, like, you think is a joke. If you know Goldfinger and you knew us as people and you knew our background, that song makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. Mm-hmm. And bro, but if you're a Goldfinger fan in fucking Iowa or something and you hear these songs, you're like, what the fuck is this? They're pretty metal for us. Do you know what I mean? And then there's songs like Getaway that are kind of odd for us. Do you know what I mean?
I think you think it's a joke in particular is a song that only Goldfinger could write. I don't think any other band could do it.
Well, for sure. That's also, that was the beginning of John's and my serious animal rights activism. So that was like the jumping off point for that stuff. And that came really into fruition, into focus on Open Your Eyes.
Open Your Eyes, yeah.
But I was only on half that record, so.
So going back to Tim, you were talking about how, there was some band tension there. A good producer can get everyone kind of going in the same direction. How did Tim keep everyone together? Kelly, I think you once described it in an interview as diffusing bombs. How did Tim keep you guys on the straight and narrow?
Well, I think his personality helped too. He was pretty like, he wasn't like a super edgy.
No, low key.
Yeah, he was pretty low key. Yeah, I mean, it's like not in like a, wimpy sort of way. He took control of shit when he had to, but it was like, mm-hmm. yeah, he was like, he's been around long enough. He knew how to deal with. I mean, he fucking dealt with David Bowie. You know what I mean? And, and who he said was amazing. He said, he told me this story. Here, I'll tell you a Tim Palmer story. Tim, if you happen to hear this, I hope I'm telling it right. But he got to work with Tin Machine, I believe, and they were listening back to something. And David was like, oh, can you turn up the blah, 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 whatever? And Tim goes, oh, go ahead and do it yourself. And he said, David looked at him and he goes, oh, no, I don't know how to work the board. I don't touch the board. And he was like, what? How many records have you done? And he goes, I don't want to know anything about that. All I want to do is live in the creative part of it.
Wow. It's like Rick Rubin.
I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically.
Yeah.
He was just like, I don't want to know the knobs. It takes away from the artistry.
Oh, that's so sick.
Either that or like he spilt too much coke in it. They wouldn't let him.
They wouldn't let him near it.
Just kidding.
I think his Berlin era cocaine days were behind him at that point.
Sure, probably pretty far behind him.
So he was pretty calm. Amidst all these,
Tim was, Tim,
oh yeah,
Tim
dude,
was,
him
yeah.
and Mark were so low key Englishmen.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Super mellow.
It's funny. He had his notification set on his laptop, and this was back in the AOL days. And instead of saying "You've got mail," his it would be a female voice and it'd say, "You've received post," and they would have tea.
Yep.
They would be drinking tea.
I think I had tea with them. I like tea.
Yeah, they brought such an English gentleman vibe to the proceedings that it cast a light on how immature and fucking idiotic we could be at times because they were the opposite.
Well, hi. Hi. You know what they were? Here's what they were. California English. They were English, but I think Tim had been in L.A. for a while. I think he was – so they had that like – chill California vibe to them, but they still have the cool English, like, oh, English wow, we're stuff. Civilized. We may tyrannically take over your continent, but we're going to stop and have tea while we do it.
Yeah. So is that John taking a little bit of a nod to those English guys and I'm down when he goes, fuck all? He uses that English term, fuck all, at the end of I'm down. Is that like a nod to those guys?
Oh, still, you mean fuck all to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. Might have been, yeah.
I love the way you sing.
I remember that song came from, we had played, this was before Kelly was in the band, we had played a Duran Duran tribute show.
Oh, yeah.
It was this weird fucking, it's hard to explain, but, and some A&R guy, I don't even think, he wasn't even with our label, and I don't even know why he was talking to us, but he was just a fucking prick, and no. He was telling us how we should do things and how we had done things wrong up to that point and all this shit. And John and I were looking at this dude like, you're going to get fucking hit. we were still, I mean, believe it or not, you know, fucking, you know, totally put together A&R guy, John Feldman. We were feral animals at that point. You know what I mean? And we were not afraid to fucking throw hands.
Throw fists.
And I'm looking at this dude, and I'm like, I'm going to punch you in the fucking mouth. And I think that song came from that encounter.
Oh, wow.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay.
Nice.
That's rad. It's a great opener. I love it. I remember the first time I heard it, it sounded better than anything. And not to get too ahead of the order in which we're talking about the record, but did you guys want to make a big, like, awesome anthemic rock record? I'm sure you guys were kind of gearing for that, but
it's got a fatter sound. Yeah,
that came from me when we came off the road from Hang Ups and we were talking about the third record. I basically put my foot down and said, I want a producer. I want somebody outside the band. You know what I mean? I wanted a mediator, because I felt like if we had gone and made yet another record with the same situation, we would have just made the same record again. Mm-hmm. And in fact, going into that record, I actually had quit the band for about a week, because all the songs that were being basically the track listing that had been settled on for the album was just a lot of more of the same.
Oh.
And I just said, look, guys, you guys all want to make the same record and I don't. And it wasn't, this was not a fuck you, I'm quitting. This was, look, man, we may have, you know, we may just be different. I mean, honestly, artistic differences. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
There's a lot of songs, like we had a song called Car Dog that was going to go on the record.
Oh,
it was this cutesy little pop punk song about John's dog.
Cause she's a car dog, sleeping on the hum. I eat them through speed bumps. She's a car dog. She watches Discovery Channel. She chews a paw. Pissed off she can't go to the beach, cause it's against the law.
A dog that I loved, by the way. But I was just like, I have no interest in making the same record a third time. And I'm like, you're gonna find a guitar player that is on board. And I had quit the band. This is one of my favorite John Feldman stories. I had been out of the band for about a week, and it was Valentine's Day. And I had a friend. I got a knock on my door at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was in bed with a friend. And I go to the door, and it's Feldy, and he wanted to talk. And as he's standing at my door, another friend, shall we say, pulled into my driveway with Valentine's Day presents for me. And John, without me saying a word, read the look on my face, knew what was going on, and he goes out to my driveway to intercept this friend and says, hey, have you seen Charlie? I'm trying to find him. He's not home. And she's like, oh, and he ran pick and roll for me.
Wow.
She took off and, you know, disaster averted. You know what I mean? And that right there, I'm like, you know what, man, this guy's my fucking brother. and we can work this out. So as a result, we changed the songs that were going to be on the record. And I completely forgot your question.
Well, it's a really eclectic record. I love the fact that like every song has its own personality.
Yeah.
There's soft parts, there's heavy parts, there's aggressive parts.
It's still, yes, but it's still, to me, having listened to it yesterday, it really has an identity. It really sounds like the four of us at that time where we were at as a band. And also, we had never been tighter. I had found there's a YouTube video of us playing The Chance in Poughkeepsie, New York, at the very beginning of that tour. And, bro, I don't know if Goldfinger has ever been tighter or more ferocious live.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I saw something from that era. Wait, you were texting me about that. Did you send me that,
a while back, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Is that the one where Feldy's guitar goes out halfway?
Yeah, there's a Vegas show. Yeah, we were really fucking happy. We were getting along really well. We were super fucking tight. Yeah, it's just, you know, in many ways, that's my favorite Goldfinger record because it was such a good time in the band's history.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
I don't mean to blow sunshine up our casers here, but I saw that footage, dude, and I was like, holy shit, is that us? Like, I was like,
bro, Kelly, wow. Kelly, you are so stoked this is not a video interview right now.
I know. I'm like,
I love it.
I'm just fucking chill.
Belushi,
man.
Laid back, legs askew.
Belushi when he does his Joe Cocker.
Exactly. No, that band was good, man. That was a fucking good band.
Yeah.
Fact.
Nice. Another reason for that was because Kelly was so about being a great musician. Like, the dude, unless he was eating or sleeping, he had his bass on. He was just constantly playing, and that made Darren and I up our game too. Like, and we all started just practicing individually more. Do you know what I mean?
Dude, Darren could play so fast, and not like, I do you remember like turning around at him something, just looking at him going like, slow the fuck down, because dude, he could play all that shit way faster. Yeah. It's insane.
Like on that tour, I remember on the bus, we would constantly be fucking just individually or together practicing or jamming, or like, I mean, Darren always had his drum pad out. He was always practicing rudiments or some shit. You know what I mean? So the whole band collectively, we just upped our game as musicians, and you know, it was a lot of fun.
That was a fun ass. Yeah, we had some crushing fucking shows, man.
Yeah,
it was a good era.
Great time.
He's skateboarding one of the videos. I think it's Counting the Days. Did he ever hurt himself on tour or anything?
Oh, constantly. We all did. We all wound up in the emergency room at least once.
Wow.
A tour or a year, you know what I mean? From stage diving, from fighting with security, from falling off skateboards, from Kelly staged over once and then some kid staged over on top of him. No. And like dislocated. Do you dislocate your shoulder or something?
I fucked around and I found out. I don't know. I've done. Do you remember Darren doing a tour with a broken leg? Were you in the band?
Yeah, we were playing some big radio festival.
No, we had a whole West Coast 2-week run.
No, we did. But what happened was Darren had we would always have like a song in the set, like a funny song where Darren would come up and sing lead, and he climbed up to the top of a 30-foot speaker column.
Oh, that was a different one.
And jumped down onto the stage, and he busted his fucking
ankle,
left foot. He busted his hi-hat foot.
So this one was actually, because you know he always played hockey in a hockey league. I think this is what Brian was in the band with. And Darren re-aggravated that very same fucking injury playing hockey. And we were all like, fuck you, it's your left leg. You better make sure that cast is from the knee down, motherfucker. So you know what he did? The doctor let him get the cast from the knee down, and he got two hi-hats like Bill Stevenson from the Descendants.
Yeah.
And he just put a closed hi-hat here, and then he went to an open one on his right next to the ride. And we did
perfect.
Second show. I completely forgot he even fucking had a broken leg. It was insane.
Wow.
Anyways.
Beat,
it was insane. That's awesome. That guy was a freak.
Unbelievable drummer.
Yeah, he's a freak. He's like, definitely that style of fucking punk rock. He can pick them up and put them down with the best of them for sure.
Charlie, you were talking a little bit earlier about how you had some ideas about the record. And I know you have a few song credits on this one, Bro, Getaway, and of course, one of my favorite songs on the record, Carry On. So tell us a little bit about your delving into songwriting and how involved you were in the songwriting for this one.
I had co-written songs on the first two records too, but Carry On actually came from a conversation with Stan from Sugar Ray and Monkey from Korn.
Wow.
I was hanging out with those guys one night and
some sugar corn.
And they were sugar. Yeah.
Sugar corn.
Monkey and I were okay. So Korn had rented a house, right behind the Rainbow, and they were all living together and rehearsing there, maybe. And basically it was the party house every fucking night. Come like one or two o'clock in the morning. I know Kelly had been there a couple times. If there was nothing else going on, we'd all just go to the Korn house, and for sure there was always something happening there. And I went up there one night and
Casa de Maze?
And it was the Korn guys. It was Stan from Sugar Ray. I think one of the Backstreet Boys there.
Nice.
And Scott Russo from Unwritten Law.
Red.
And we're all kind of just sitting around jamming, playing guitar. And I came up with the riff for Carry On. And Monkey was like, "That's fucking badass." And in fact, he wound up loaning me some guitars because on 99 Red Balloons and a couple other songs, there's a low 7-string on that.
Oh, yeah.
Those are his guitars.
Oh, really?
Carry On came from that jam session. And then I was also jamming with Royce, who was in Suicide Machines at the time.
Yeah.
And the reggae section of that song came from playing with him. So I took this sort of Korn-inspired riff and the Suicide Machines-inspired riff, and those became Carry On.
Wow, I love it.
Yeah.
I'll never listen to that song the same way again.
Yeah.
But it makes perfect sense. I love the chorus, too. The chorus almost has kind of like a late 90s alternative radio rock vibe. Like, it's the only one.
Okay, you're not going to believe this, but my inspiration for that was pure Zeppelin.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah, I in fact, when we were recording that song, I kept telling Kelly in the chorus, "Dude, John Paul Jones," and he fucking nailed it. Like, if you listen to that chorus now and you think of JPJ and listen to what Kelly's playing, it'll make sense.
That's so right.
Like, and also there's that big sitar at the top of the chorus. Yeah. Feldy would hate hearing this. But yeah, that was purely Zeppelin inspired.
Do you know a Zeppelin fan?
John hates classic rock.
Oh, really?
He likes the Beatles and he likes the Who, and he begrudgingly likes Hendrix, but that's it.
Yeah,
he fucking hates Zeppelin, he hates the Stones, you know what I mean? But there's a lot of shit in Carry On. And also the solo section was sort of Radiohead inspired, because if you listen to the solo, it's not a solo. It's really like, it's me just playing with feedback and a delay.
Like, yeah, going backwards a little bit. Yeah, that's cool. I always like that solo. It's like, it's like swelling.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting little noisy tidbits and whatnot. Let's talk about, if you don't mind me hijacking, At the End of the Day. Let's talk about that one.
Spread lies about me.
We had, you know, understandably caught the fucking
the ire
of a lot of the punk rock intelligentsia at the time. We were, you know, because we were
the
fucking sellouts
police.
And we were on MTV and
yeah,
exactly, the punk police.
Ugh.
And I had run into the editor of Flipside at a bar one night. And he had fucking just been merciless with us.
Mm.
And I went up to him and I said, "Look, man, I grew up reading your magazine. I fucking love Flipside. I had been reading Flipside since I was probably 15. And I said, I don't know why you even care about us.
Have such a hard on.
We are a fucking, we are a high energy, pop band with, like, we have punk and ska influences. I never thought we were a punk band, honestly. I really didn't. And I thought we came more from the Police school of things. And the fact that you even acknowledge us, you know, is kind of ridiculous. I mean, I like seeing my band in your magazine, but you're going out of your way to include us in something just so you can shit on us. And it's fucking petty. And he had some snarky fucking response and he was being a prick. And I said, all right, dude, I'm going to tell you what. You can leave now. And I basically told him, I'm letting you leave. And he, some big friend of his walked him out. And that was that, you know, and then, so then
and
not
here's
long
the funny
after
part is,
that,
we're such fucking sellouts that the Dead Kennedys let us use a fucking, one of their fucking sound bites to tell the guy from Flipside to eat a dick. So fucking.
I love that.
Yeah, that's true. In fact, when we were mixing that song, I played it for DH Peligro from the Dead Kennedys. Yeah. And he was like,
rip.
And he was in my car, just like, fuck, that is so fucking cool. You know what I mean? Like, Kelly and I were pretty good friends with DH. Mm-hmm. And he was all about it. He's like, fuck those motherfuckers, dude. You know what I mean? that was the inspiration for that song, was all the shit that we were catching in, like, Flipside and Maximum Rock and Roll and all those, you know, punker than now.
Getting the punk
sources.
Rock test.
Which is funny, because not trying to pull any fucking punk cred bullshit card, because I don't give a fuck. But I fucking, you know, played in some fucking real fucking punk rock bands. And I was just like, what in the actual... fuck, why does this fucking guy even give a fuck?
I know, what a waste of energy.
To sum up Goldfinger, or my take on it, like, the story of Carry On is a perfect example. Like, dude, I love punk rock. You know, I grew up riding skateboards and fucking seeing the Jerks and all those bands. But I also love, like I said, AC/DC and Van Halen. Mm-hmm. I love Fishbone. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? I love Judas Priest. I love The Temptations.
I like good music.
You know what I mean? Yeah, so... I was happy because I'm hosting some tours of the Punk Rock Museum this weekend.
Oh, nice.
And I was having a conversation with somebody about it recently. I said, you can always tell the difference between somebody who got into punk rock through music and somebody who got into music through punk rock.
Mm. Oh, I mean? Right. Yeah.
And
for
I
sure.
got into punk rock through music.
Yeah.
And so I embraced it as great fucking music, and I love the ethic, and I love the attitude, and I love the lifestyle, and I believe deeply in what punk rock stands for. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to put on a fucking a Lady Gaga record, because those first two records are fucking badass.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
A good song is a good
song.
So,
and I think that song and that album really encapsulates that. Like, we are fucking musicians first. We all love punk rock. We all come from it. Kelly was in fucking Fear, for goddamn fuck's sake. But we're fucking musicians first.
Yeah, we fucking love music. I just like good songs. I like good music. I don't give a fuck. As long as you're not some, you know. It's really hard. Sometimes I'm teaching myself how to separate the art from the artist. And that's been that's been like my growing thing, where I'm actually like, oh, I can listen to this because I'm listening to this person in 1970, 80, whatever. And, you know, but it's like, dude, for a while there, I was like, I can't listen to that guy. Fuck him. Now I'm just like, oh, you know what? I'm going to listen to the art and forget the artist.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. I mean, Pop Sensibilities. Even Ramones and Sex Pistols and The Clash, they had really catchy pop sensibilities in their songs. And I mean, they're not.
Dude, the Ramones they wanted to be like the Ronettes or whatever, but like
they loved R&B. Yeah.
The Ramones wanted to be the Shangri-Las.
Yeah.
They didn't set out to invent punk rock. Mm-hmm. Steve Jones and Paul Cook wanted to be the fucking Bay City Rollers. You know what I mean? The Clash were total fucking carpetbaggers. But you're still talking about the three probably most important punk bands of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So it's all bullshit.
Good tunes are good tunes, baby.
While we're on the topic of good tunes, what's the story behind covering 99 Red Balloons?
Fuck, what is this? I think, what was
Tim
that?
And,
I
Tim just, and...
I feel like covers are, every label wants, hey, we got to do a cover. It's already a bona fide hit. Mm. It's like they're hedging their bet.
I had been talking to Feldy, and we were tracking guitars one day, and I've been talking to them about, Naked Eyes, I think, had done a cover of Always Something There to Remind Me. Oh, it was a huge hit in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, there's these fucking songwriters that certainly nobody in punk or in pop music at the time even remembered, like not Leonard Cohen. I can't remember, but like there's these great fucking songwriters that have these huge collections of brilliant pop songs that nobody even knows about. And I said, it'd be cool if we like went and found some undiscovered gem, like Always Something There to Remind Me, and covered that. Sort of the way Soft Cell did, baby, don't leave me, whatever that Supreme song, all of, and like, it'd be cool if we could do something like that. And basically by the time that went through everybody's fucking filter, they had come back with, I think it was 99 Red Balloons and maybe Karma Chameleon by Culture Club, which I love.
Which is a great R&B song.
Yeah,
but we settled on 99 Red Balloon. Well, they settled on it. I did not want to do it. Not want to do it because, to me, 7 Seconds had done the definitive version of 99 Red Balloons.
That's right.
And I still love their version of that.
And now we are the definitive.
I wouldn't say that. I think the compromise was, okay, let's make it heavier.
Yeah, let's do the 7-string guitar.
If we're going to do it, let's not just do a...
Let's not just do a punk rock version of it. Super low.
That's why there's heavy guitars in the bridge, and there's an 808, and John did that cool production thing of Behind Blue Eyes with the intro. That's the Who.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So we decided to, if we're gonna do this, let's get away from the 7 Seconds version and make it more of a production thing.
Oh, you're talking about the panning at the very beginning, where it's going from speaker to.
Yeah, the backwards drums and the all that I think that's a sample of Behind Blue Eyes.
Oh wow, that's cool.
Or something, or maybe something off Quadrophenia. I'm not
sure.
That's
really cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna take credit for that. Was my idea. I'm taking credit. I give a fuck.
Was it?
Awesome.
No. It was my idea to do the fucking last verse in German. That was my idea.
Oh, all right.
Oh, yeah.
Feldy, you have to learn German for that. Huh?
Feldy doesn't know any other version. He doesn't know the. He always sings that every time he does the Fox to the East. I heard it enough time. I can almost fucking sing it.
I don't know the words. Yeah.
Yeah, I could almost sing it. But no. That's the only version he knows now, because that's the only version we play or have played. Awesome. Right? Because he still does it in German.
I've always loved the way John really enunciates when he sings. He really enunciates his words. I always practice to John when I'm like warming up, because I don't enunciate as well as he does. But he like over enunciates on that German verse. It's so amazing.
I love it.
And I think somebody at the label was German and came down to the studio or came over to his when he recorded it. I think did he do the?
Yeah, somebody sort of tutored him.
Yeah, he had
coached him through it.
Yeah, he had a good. Yeah. He had a tutor.
And then we also did a version of the song all in German, which was the single in Germany, and it was like a top 5 hit. Like,
oh,
that,
wow.
Yeah.
It was, Jay, do you remember?
It's funny, like the first two records didn't really, I mean, we did okay in Europe with those records, but what had happened before Stomping Ground came out was Tony Hawk came out with Superman, and then we released 99 Red Balloons, and those songs just completely exploded in Europe. And we would go, the first two records, we would tour Europe and we would play, you know, festivals and stuff, but we'd play like 500 seat clubs, you know what I mean? And then we came back and we were like playing fucking huge rooms because of those songs.
Wow. That's
amazing.
I knew something was going on when, cause we had Motor Music was our label over there. They were fucking great. I think anyways. I remember going into an electronic shop. I don't even know. Maybe Darren was somewhere around, or Charlie. I don't. And some, I knew something was going on. The video was getting played when this kid came up to me and goes, "Excuse me, are you Kelly from Goldfinger?" And I was just like, "What the fuck?" And he just goes, "Oh, I see your video on Viva Svi." And I was like, "All right, well, I just got approached on the street," and it was really weird.
That's
it
amazing. Fucking,
it did pretty cool there. Do you remember going back over there with the Bloodhound Gang, Charlie?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Fuck, that was crazy. That was crazy because we did. It was a co-headlining until we got to Germany, and it started in the UK, and we did all the same small rooms. And I just remember, like, every other show, the Bloodhound Gang guys would go, "Hey, sorry about this, man. We get to Germany, it's going to be way different. We swear, we're not making it up." And we're just like, yeah, whatever. And, like, you know, we got all the way through the UK, did some France and Italy, little small shows, and we get to fucking...
I don't remember that at all.
Dude, oh, my God, I do. And we get to freaking Germany. Yeah, because don't you remember we filmed that video in Dusseldorf, the 99 Red Balloons?
No, I remember playing Germany with him. I don't remember.
You remember the UK shit?
No.
You deleted it. I remember all that shit because they, they kept fucking, they were always.
Not enough room on the hard drive.
Dude, you deleted that. No, I just remember thinking, like, okay, let's see. And we get to Germany and, like, the first one's in Berlin and it's like fucking 15,000 people or some shit. They had just knocked. They just, one fierce beer coaster had just knocked the Backstreet Boys out of number one in Germany. They were the fucking Hasselhoffs of the fucking 2000, man. It was crazy.
That's crazy.
It was
Doesn't
insane.
Does the bass player live there now?
Yeah, Jared. I still talk to Jared sometimes. He's cool. Yeah. I love Jared.
He's like,
he's a trip. He's a trip, man. He's a trip. He's a good dude. He's a trip, though. I always got along with those guys. They're all just a bunch of Pennsylvania rednecks.
What were the most fun songs to play live back then? From this record,
ooh, San Simeon for sure was always a good one.
Yeah, it's funny.
Counting the Days.
I think the best.
Calm Down.
As much as I love You Think It's a Joke or Carry On or Get Away, the best Goldfinger songs on that record are the ones that sound like Goldfinger, and I think that's San Simeon. Mm-hmm. Although the lyrics are sort of questionable. If you know anything about the history of the actual place. Pick a Fight, Counting the Days, I'm Down. Those are straight up Goldfinger pop punk songs. And I think those have aged the best. Pick a Fight's probably... Pick a Fight's probably my favorite song on the record.
Yeah, we hardly
now. I mean, it could change.
But did you guys? You still don't play that, do you?
No, because
he made us change keys.
There's reasons.
We did it with Brian for a while.
Well, everything we play is in a different key now. Like 99 on the record is in E. Now we play it in D flat. Mm-hmm. I remember even back on that tour, we played Pick a Fight, and I had to detune for it because it was just too fucking high for John to sing live.
Yeah, I noticed on the quarantine version that Counting the Days was a half step down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's what happens. I mean, not everybody can...
I mean, dude, John was probably 30 when we made that record, and now, you know, he's almost 60, so...
Dude, it's the same... all those bands, man, you don't keep your high out. It's just like your skin's elasticity, man. That shit fucking goes, so... As long as you maintain it, sometimes you got to tune down a half step. That's a long time to sing.
Oh, yeah. But it's okay.
I mean, I feel, you know, Brian Johnson from AC/DC, that guy painted himself in a fucking corner, man.
He did.
Yeah. Oh, God.
No, Mutt Lang painted him into a corner. So when Brian Johnson joined AC/DC, he had never sung like that. If you listen to his band before.
There's a little bit, like he teeters on it a little bit. But he doesn't. They
but he
don't take
more
it,
like
go,
Phil Lynott.
Yeah, but he would do. Yeah. He had moments of the upper register because I just saw some shit.
But
yeah, you're right.
But Mutt Lange and the Young Brothers, basically talked him into screaming and singing like that. He had never done that before. Not really. Not to that extent. And that became the vocal sound of AC/DC. You know what I mean? I think that because the Young Brothers loved Bon, and obviously Bon's the greatest, but Brian was capable of shit that Bon wasn't, and they were excited about that. It's kind of like when Kelly came into the band. It's like, oh, we have this new toy to play with. Mm. And you know, it kind of, while those fucking those first couple of AC/DC records with Brian are fucking amazing, it destroyed his voice.
Yeah, I mean, could say that about a couple of other singers, even guys that filled in for AC/DC singers.
Oh yeah, Kelly and I were talking just yesterday about Rob Halford. Mm-hmm. Dude, we are so gonna lose Goldfinger.
I know, right? Everybody's off.
It's okay.
But we're talking about AC/DC.
There's
you
famous... want to
talk about jazz? We can talk about jazz too.
Yeah, there's a famous
for everybody.
There's a famous gig on Ozfest where Black Sabbath were going to open for themselves. They were going to do the Heaven and Hell, Ronnie James Dio era songs, and then come out and do the Ozzy era songs. And of course, Ronnie James Dio was like, fuck you, I don't want anything to do with Sharon. I'm not doing it. So Rob Halford came and he sang those songs. And it sounds like Rob Halford singing Black Sabbath songs. He has blown his voice out in a different way. Like, he can't sing the low shit. Like, when they play You Got Another Thing Coming or Electric Eye and that kind of shit, all the low growly shit, he just screams his way through it. So he can still do the screamy shit, but he can't do the low shit.
Yeah.
That's weird.
It's hard, man. Yeah. Being a singer is, I mean, it's your body's your instrument. You gotta fucking, it's like me and Charlie, we can fucking, you know, slap the snot out of our fucking guitars and throw it down and go do something else. If you're a singer, you got to drag that shit everywhere, man.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like the adrenaline won't allow you to go that low because you kind of have to be in a neutral, calm place to do it, do that kind of low registry stuff. So like if you're in the middle of a show, it's almost hard to go lower.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. What band are you in?
I'm in a band called Game Time.
Okay, cool. And is it like pop punk?
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. Okay. I've played in other bands, heavier bands and stuff. So yeah. I like it all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I am in a band called Game Time, and we just recently got back together.
Cool, man.
Hey, man.
And you're the singer, I take it.
I sing. Yeah. We have two singers.
Okay.
We're getting the band back together, man.
Woo!
Yeah, dude.
Nice.
Yeah. No, we're all massive Goldfinger fans. Awesome. It's a huge thrill for me.
Oh, right on.
I'm a big fan.
Nice.
You guys hit me up about doing this a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, oh, dude, we definitely have to have Kelly on this pod, and I'm glad.
I'm home.
I'm so glad.
There's things that he remembers that are gone to me entirely.
Yeah.
you guys both shred on this album.
Vice versa. Oh, yeah. Charlie fucked it up. Did you used to, like, I think Charlie, like, set up, like, a shrine. Did you have a shrine set up? Why do I picture that in my head right now?
So, when I was young and dumb and way more resilient, I used to record my guitars in the ISO booth with my cab. So I would go sit in there.
Wow.
What?
And yeah, exactly. And set up the ISO booth with, you know, I had where we recorded was right next to this store in Burbank called Dark Delicacies, and it was basically all horror movie paraphernalia and shit.
I
like
remember that.
So I went in there and I got an Exorcist poster and, you know, like a cool creepy coffin ashtray, whatever, and I had put up like I'd hung a sign over the door that said morgue, you know what I mean, and I would just sit in there and chain smoke and fucking
record most of
my guitars in that booth.
You were a full smoker then too,
and all your dark clothes. Yeah. And that's awesome.
Did they have it cranked?
Huh?
Charlie was
they had it cranked.
Oh yeah, of course he did.
Oh yeah, I was fucking loud.
Yeah.
So the ISO booth had a window to the live room where Darren was. So between my cans and being able to see Darren, that's how I played in time. Because I was so fucking loud that I couldn't hear the cans that well. So I was playing by sight.
Just watching his arms.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Ooh. Oh, I just had a memory. Tim Palmer. God bless you, Tim. Tim said, hey, man. Hey, mate. You've only got like one song left, mate. Yeah, you think it's a joke. He goes, why don't you go out tonight and get really fucking hammered, right? Hey, I'm not even doing a good English, let alone Tim. Tim's sounds way more eloquent and fucking cooler. But anyways, he goes, why don't you go out, get fucking shit-faced, and come in hungover tomorrow, and let's track that bass. And I just looked at him and go, are you serious? He goes, yeah, sometimes you play differently. Sometimes you like get these fucking inspirations, and it just, and I'm like, all right, because I really liked to do that back then. I was young and dumb, and my all my internal organs worked properly at the time. But anyways, so I did, and I played You Think It's a Joke on it, and I really, really liked the bass on that. I played a 5-string Warwick thumb, a black one that my buddy Eddie Nappy let me use. And I remember using your buddy Johnny, who had passed away, his P bass on I'm Down and maybe End of the Day and some of the other kind of more punk rocky ones. Because you always got to play P bass on the punk rock.
Don't say goodbye,
definitely want to talk about this album cover art. So tell us the story about how this whole thing came together.
I fucking hate it.
I can't tell by the look on your face, Charlie, on this thing. But.
I fucking hate it, dude. When it was sold to me as like, it's like a Godzilla movie poster. And I'm like, fuck yeah. But what wound up, what from that idea to what to fruition? No. In fact, I think there's like an Instagram profile of like goofiest album covers of all time, and that has definitely made it.
That's
on
it. I just love it.
Is it?
I kind of love it. Is actually. I love where the parental advisory sticker is.
Is it, dare I say, iconic? For being definitely. Bad?
Yeah, for the wrong reasons.
It's totally iconic.
But it's like so bad it's good. You know how like things are so bad they're good? Like I just love how the only like Darren is like totally into it. Like, you know, he's like really taking on the character.
I think it's funny as shit, man. I think it's fucking hilarious.
I mean, yeah, it's funny. I don't know if that's what we intended it to be at the time, but it's definitely funny. And Darren was game for anything, dude. Anything that would humiliate himself, he did not care. He would go for it.
Let's do it.
Hence the Twinkie in the ass. You know what I mean? Like,
you know what's funny is? You know how that started, Charlie? That twink in the ass? Do you remember?
No.
It was back in the Brian time, the Brian era. We're just going to call it from now on, the B. Arthur era. How's that? the fucking Occidental College.
Oh my God! How have I never thought of that?
You're welcome.
B. Arthur.
So that's the B. Arthur era. Anyways.
Golden Finger Girls?
Yes, yes!
Oh, I love it.
Oh my God.
Wow. Got something going here.
That's a t-shirt, bro. I gotta be on it. Yeah. I want credit. Or partial.
Okay.
I gotta be on the, at least make me in the back being like a fucking, one of the smaller characters.
With this picture.
Exactly. Anyways, so the PA blew out at Occidental College in Riverside. And for some odd reason, a donut ended up on stage and in Darren's butt. And like, you know, how he has it kind of hanging out of his butt cheek. So you can actually bite it without touching his butthole. And initially a girl came up and did it. And we were like, I was just like, oh yeah, this is going to get us in trouble. And then since Jackass was so huge, it turned into the Twinkie thing. So,
Yeah, I watched a dude do it.
Oh man, I've met guys that are like, dude, I ate the Twinkie twice, and I'm like, wow. I go, what do you do? And he goes, I'm a fucking ER doctor. I'm all, well, that's probably a good thing. You can give yourself a tetanus shot.
That's incredible. That's so amazing.
Oh, it's pretty funny. That's real shit there. Dangerous Darren. Dangerous to himself and others. But I'd say as far as that record goes, I think everybody kicked ass. Charlie fucking tore it up. Fucking some really cool guitar shit on there. I actually got to go back and listen to it a little more. I skimmed and scanned it, but I was like, fuck yeah, dude. We were on our fucking game.
Yeah, it's a fun record.
It was a fun time, man. It was a fun time.
Zero
regrets other than those nasty hangovers. That's the thing that really, like, I was just like, oh, really, really was super just green. I just remember getting in my car, like, oh, fuck me. Am I going to throw up? And then, like, we all had headphones on, and we're playing I'm Down. Do back to la putanimo. Trying not to puke while I'm playing it. Anyways.
It's a fast
one.
Oh,
my God. Yeah. Don't miss that shit.
Well, this was awesome, guys. Thank you so much for doing this and talking about Stomping Ground with us and going through the songs and stuff. This was You made our jobs easier. We didn't really have to ask half the questions we wrote down. Because
yeah,
well, I think part of it is because, I mean, I don't know about Kelly, but because I haven't listened to the record in so long.
Nope, I haven't either.
When I put it on, all these fucking memories started coming.
Yep, same.
Awesome.
All right, fellas.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, guys. Thanks a lot.
Take care. Thank you for the
I'm going to go go listen to that some more and do a deep dive and then have more emotional feelings.
Then you'll have more stories.
I'm like, oh, my God, I remember this. Oh, my God, I remember this. Oh, my.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Peace out. See you guys.
Can't be happy without you. Can't be happy without me. Still, you always want to.
All right, Kyle, and that about does it. Our chat with Charlie and Kelly, a lot of fun. I really enjoyed just listening to those two guys go off. You know, like I feel like we wrote so many questions we didn't even have to ask because they're rolling.
Yeah, so much fun. I could have listened to them talk for another 2 hours, honestly.
Yeah, edit us out. You know, just leave them in, let them talk. You know, I love that. I love that. Just listening to those stories and seeing how like excited they were to have those memories and just be chatting. Like to me, that's what this is all about, you know?
Yeah. And you can tell like they're still tight knit friends. They're brothers.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to thank you, Kyle, for hanging out tonight. I'd like to thank you for coming on the podcast and being a good friend of the podcast as well. Thank you
so much, man. I'm honored. I appreciate it.
I'd like to thank Charlie and Kelly for being available to chat with us tonight. I'd like to thank various sources around the internet where I was able to dig out some information, Modern Drummer, the website and music we trust, Alternative Press, among other places. I would like to thank Chris DeMakes from Less Than Jake for the theme music. And, of course, I would like to thank all of you for listening to Talking Records. It is so much fun. We have a blast, don't we, Kyle? We have a blast digging
yeah,
into these fantastic records, chat about the songs, and try to gather up all the information we can and just put it all here. You know, one-stop shop for just everything you want to know about a record. Make sure you check out Talking Records, but also make sure you check out Kyle's podcast, Having a Blast. Tell us real quick about your podcast.
So I talk to guests, and invariably I'm really interested in things like personal development, but I'm always curious how these musicians or producers landed in the spots they do. So we talk about self-development and the journey, and we try to have a blast when we're doing it, having a blast.
It's a great podcast. I love listening, Kyle. I love the way you get some of that information that you don't normally hear from artists to open up a little bit and talk about, you know, not only the music, but like some of the stuff that comes along with the music, you know?
Yeah. Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
Always enjoy that. All right, folks. Well, make sure you check us out on the socials. Say hello. Suggest albums we should talk about. Tell us how you got into Goldfinger. Kyle, till next time, my man.
Dude, yeah. Take care. And have a great rest of your week, man.
You too.
Yeah, thanks again.